WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Crushing debt has called into question the solvency of Greece, Spain, and Italy, among other nations. The United States has more debt today than in the entire history of the nation. So many Western nations have racked up such a massive amount of debt that it seems doubtful it can ever be repaid, and that holds the promise of significant defaults. We think we've never seen anything like this before outside of the Great Depression, but apparently what we're witnessing is a time-worn pattern of economic history, and each time the world has been through this, it has become reshaped. So how did we get here, and what will be the result? Philip Coggan writes about this in his book, Paper Promises, Money, Debt, and the New World Order, the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist. He joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. As you know, we're in the middle of this presidential campaign, and the economy and jobs and the national debt are major topics of conversation among the candidates. And although the previous Republican president took us into debtor land from the surpluses of the Clinton administration because of fighting two wars off book, I suppose, and also the cutting of taxes, President Obama has increased that debt even more than President Bush did. We are told that these numbers are unprecedented in terms of real numbers, but not in terms of behavior, you say. Put this into historical perspective for us.
Well, if you go back over history, you can see this battle between creditors and debtors being replayed time after time after time. And you mentioned the 1930s and the Great Depression. There was a big presidential campaign in 1896 when William Jennings Bryan, who was representing the farming community, which had debts, he wanted free silver. He wanted to abolish the gold standard and to have inflation erode the debts. You can go back into the founding years of the Republic and the battle between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And the U.S. started in debt. And, of course, it's not just the U.S. Greece, when it first became an independent nation, it took on debts and for the first 10 or 15 years, it didn't pay those debts at all. So almost half the lifetime of Greece has been in debt. Now, it's all about, really, the way that money plays a role in the system. So if you think about it, money has two key functions. The first is that it's a means of exchange. I went in, bought my Starbucks, so I was awake for your show this morning, straight off the flight. And I handed over a piece of paper and they gave me goods in exchange. Now, had I had to give them a little lecture about debt or the euro or the presidential election, they might have got bored, the queue would have got very long, and we wouldn't have got far. So you need money to hand things over.
Right.
And the second function is a store of value. So I want to be sure that $10 will buy me a couple of grande non-fat lattes next year, just as it does this year. But those two functions are really in conflict. So if we want more transactions to take place, more trade, we want to increase the amount of money. If we want the money to keep its value, we want to limit its supply.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, we've gone back and forth between the two systems. And when we've gone too far one way or the other, we've had a crisis and the whole system's been remade.
And you call this, and we'll get into this as we go through the program, you call this an age-old battle between creditors and debtors that seems to be repeat itself over and over. You mentioned that William Jennings Bryan advocated free silver as a way to expunge the debts. And your nation, Great Britain, just recently celebrated the Jubilee of the Queen, I believe. But the word Jubilee has a different meaning than we call it a celebration.
Yeah.
That's not what Jubilee started as, is it?
No, it's not. It's an ancient tradition. There was a Jewish tradition that debts would be forgiven every 50 years. So you'd wipe the slate out and everybody could start again. And there are people around. There's a guy called David Graeber, who's popular in the Occupy movement, who thinks this whole thing should happen this time soon. And it probably was a symptom of exactly the same thing. People get very optimistic. They take on debt, you know, to build up businesses, to buy property. And prices go up. The bankers lend them more money. Prices keep going up until you stretch the elastic too far. Or to use another analogy, like the cartoon character, you run off the cliff and then you look down and you realize you can't afford to pay all this back. Then you get the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get either the debt being written off or it being inflated away, debase the currency. The old Roman emperors would do this, would just melt down the coins and add copper or lead. Mm-hmm. And some people think quantitative easing is the same process.
Going back to Judea and the ancient Jewish tradition of having these jubilees where debt was forgiven every 50 years, you also point out that these crises occur about every 40 years. So maybe they had their finger on the pulse of what to do. What would happen if we had a debt holiday? Suddenly everybody around the world had no debts. I had no mortgage left, no car payment left. We started from scratch. What would happen?
Well, the trouble there is that your debt is someone else's bank deposit. So anybody who's seen It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, mm-hmm. where they want to withdraw their money from their accounts because they're worried about the bank, and he says you can't because it's in so-and-so's shop and so-and-so's farm. The same way, if you abolished all the debts, then our banks would go bust. So then what would we have to do? We would have to rescue the banks, just as happened in 2007, 2008. And of course, the government would take on the debts that the banks had. So in terms of wiping out the overall debts, we might not get very far. And that's one point you mentioned in your introduction, that we have more debt under President Obama than we did before. But we don't really. We have, in America, we have slightly less debt than when President Obama took office, but almost all of it's been transferred from the private sector to the government. So you see this in places all around the world, that the total amount of debt is pretty much unchanged. Actually, America is one of the few countries that's got a little bit of it down. But now that debt has been taken off the books of the banks, if you like, and onto the hands of the government.
Because prior to this Great Recession, we did several programs on the massive amount of consumer debt, how individual people had taken on too much debt, and they needed to start reducing that amount and saving more as they did in other nations. Our savings rate, I think, was the lowest of any Western country at that time. I think that's right. And now you're saying that we've gotten our individual savings and spending down because of the recession, but the government is taking it all on its back.
Exactly.
They have a choice?
They probably didn't have a choice about taking most of it onto their books. What happens when we stop spending is that tax revenues fall, corporate tax revenues fall, and of course, when we stop spending, there's less demand for goods in our factories, so people lose their jobs. So government spending on things like unemployment benefits goes up. So there's a natural way that you move into deficit mm-hmm. when you fall into recession. Now, obviously, this government tried to put forward a stimulus plan, which widened the deficit significantly too. But, you know, China did a much bigger stimulus plan in 2009, and China's doing fine. So it's not that stimulus plans are wrong. It's just whether or not you put the money in the right place. Of course.
Your book is about the cyclical nature of this and what happens as a result of booms and busts, one of which we're experiencing right now. We know that this happens over and over again. Even though we in America have really short memories, we know that this happened in the 80s. We know that it happened in the 70s. We know that it happened in the Great Depression. We know that it happened, I think many people know that it happened, in the late 1800s. We have these major recessions. Why then do we keep repeating the same behavior that leads to these bubbles and bursts over and over and over?
I think it must be a generational thing. My father was of a generation who lived through the 30s, and he wouldn't have a credit card. He'd seen what debt could do to families and businesses, so that was the attitude he formed when he was growing up. When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, there was inflation. It was easier and easier to take on debt. You know, we didn't have credit cards until 60s, 70s, did we? It was harder to get a mortgage. Businesses like to have a sound balance sheet. That became unfashionable. So you get habits that you acquire. And for a while, it works brilliantly. Everybody who, you know, bought a house in, the mid-90s, by the mid-2000, 2005, 2006, thought they were genius. Alan Greenspan was treated by a genius. While the party's going, you know, and we're all having another glass of punch, we all feel we're doing fantastically. It's only in the morning that we wake up with a hangover.
But surely somebody knew it was a house of cards.
Well, various people did try to point it out. There was Ireland is one of the places where that happened. And there was a professor in Ireland who said 2005, about 2 years before the crisis. And the Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, suggested that he should get a treatment for mental illness, that he was so gloomy that there was something wrong with his psychology. So those kind of people tend to be looked down on because everybody's making money and feeling fine. So that's just some old Cassandra in the corner.
Well, there was a time where people did not take on debt. Individuals did not take on debt. It was regarded as immoral to take on debt. Debt was a bad thing. But then suddenly people wanted things, I guess. They wanted to be able to build or buy a house, and so a mortgage became necessary. They wanted to be able to buy a car, so a car payment, a loan for the car, for the furniture in the house became necessary. And I would imagine that that led to growth, because the more we spend, the more factories churn out, the more paychecks go out, the more we spend. It's a nice little cycle, and it builds and builds and builds. But if we're doing it all on credit, does it always have to go bust?
No, it doesn't. I mean, more sophisticated societies have more debt. China probably needs more consumer debt. It's harder if you're Chinese to get a house than it is in America. It's harder to buy consumer goods than it is here. But there obviously is a limit. And the trouble with these debt cycles is they overinflate themselves. So the great thing about debt is if the economy is growing, people's incomes are growing and the population is growing, then it's easier to pay it off. Now, in Europe, the reason why, as I'm coming from Europe, we have a particular problem is the demography is such that the population isn't growing and in some countries is set to shrink and the economy isn't growing very fast. So if you think about taking on debt like a mortgage, you usually do it when you're optimistic and you think your income's going to grow. If you know your income's going to be flat for years and years and years, you're unlikely to take on that extra borrowing.
So I've been putting this in terms of consumer spending and individual prosperities or lack of same. What's happening around the world today has to do with governments, does it not? Spain and Italy and Portugal and Ireland and the United States to a certain degree.
Well, again, it's governments taking on the debts that previously were in the private sector. So in Ireland, before this crisis, they had virtually no government debt to GDP. Spain was only 50% or so. It's the fact that their banks expanded so much. The banks have gotten to terrible trouble because they were lending on lots of property developments in the coast of Spain. The governments have to bail out the banks, and then it becomes government debt. And so it's a function not of particularly government action. It's all of us in the economy, the finance sector, the corporate sector, the consumer sector, and the governments together. That's the total level of debt that we need to worry about.
And these nations all over the world that have assumed a consumer debt for the sake of what? The country, I suppose. Did they have a choice? Should they have done it? What would have happened had they just let consumers, the banks go bust because consumers couldn't pay back the debts? What would have happened?
Well, we would probably have had something very similar to the Great Depression. If you remember, a lot of banks went bust in the Great Depression. What happens if your bank goes bust? You lose your deposits.
But isn't this just a temporary fix? In other words, if to thwart Great Depression, the governments of the countries in trouble, like Greece, begin to take on all of the debt. They shore up the banks, but then they don't have the money to pay those debts off. Aren't they just kicking the can down the road?
That was certainly the case with Greece. If you run a trade deficit for years and years and years, then you're borrowing money from foreigners, and you cannot, in the end, keep going by printing money or whatever. You have to reform. But America, of course, does borrow money from foreigners, but at the moment it's only paying 1.5-2% to borrow money for foreigners. Excuse me. So the foreigners are getting a very bad deal. So America's got more years to do it. But if you go back, I was interviewing Alistair Darling, who's the British finance minister, and during the crisis. And he was called by the Royal Bank of Scotland, one of our biggest banks, and said, "We will not be able to carry on for the next past 2 hours. You will not get cash out of the cash machines." Now, you would have to be a very, very bold finance minister to say, "Fine, you go bust. I'll worry about it in the morning."
We'll continue this conversation about the world economy and the cycles of boom and bust, debt, money, and the new world order with Philip Coggin in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, providing local, comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, gogaragedoorguru.com. Coming up tomorrow, another holiday rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks. Women's issues were some of the key issues this past presidential election season. That attention has brought women into the spotlight in a variety of ways, including through literature. Alisa Chappell knows this well. She's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, who's not only a book critic for Women's Magazine, but writes about women as well. She joined us to talk about writing for and about women and their impact on politics, and we replay that show tomorrow at 9. A reminder, this is also a holiday rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks, so we won't be able to take your phone calls this morning. Back to the conversation in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, tax and spending, gun control, and immigration. Analysts weigh in on top national issues for the White House and Congress in 2013.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning, right after Charlotte Talks, from 10 to noon, here on your NPR news source, listener-funded public radio, WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Philip Coggin is our guest, the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist newspaper and author of Paper Promises, Money, Debt, and the New World Order. He's here in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. You call your book Paper Promises to refer to the practice of exchanging goods and services for paper, as opposed to gold or silver, which was the standard for millennia, it seems to me. Paper is exactly that. It says so on the money.
Yeah.
It's a promise to pay. I don't know what the promise is based on, because it's not based on gold or silver. What is the promise based on?
It's based on nothing. It's like Peter Pan, which is the we have it, an annual pantomime at the end. The kids are asked to clap if they believe in fairies. Otherwise, Tinkerbell will die.
That's right.
And they all clap. And we, every day, when Starbucks does take my dollars or pounds and gives me a coffee in exchange, they're expressing that faith. And of course, it's not just paper these days. You know, most money is now just blips on a computer. When you have this thing called quantitative easing,
right,
the central bank buys bonds from an investor and credits their account with new money. It's as if, you know, a benign computer hacker has gotten to your account overnight and, you know, just added some money in instead of taking it away.
Well, isn't that what happens sometimes to ease the situation? We print more money. And in this case, maybe we don't even print it. We just add more to the computer tape. And the computer says, oh, look, I've got $100,000 more in here. Doesn't that cause all kinds of problems? Because money can change value in an instant.
It does. And that's why there are problems around the world. And obviously, if you overdo it, as they did in Germany in the 1920s, as they did in Zimbabwe in recent years, you can create hyperinflation. Of course, if you underdo it and you don't have enough money, then people stop being able to trade. That means of exchange function falls down because people don't want to use their money to spend on goods, and then there aren't jobs around. So it's like Goldilocks's porridge. You have to get it not too hot, not too cold, but just right.
And isn't one of the tools in the toolkit that government has to get itself out of situations like we find ourselves in today to simply inflate the money?
Yes, absolutely. That's the privilege that we have in Britain and America and other countries, not in the European Union, not in the Eurozone, to create your own money and pay back the debtors in that newly created money.
Those of us who are not terribly acquainted with the Eurozone rules, why can't they do the same?
Well, in the Eurozone, you're a nation and you have your own debts, but you have pooled your money together with all the other nations. So you don't get to print euros. If you're the Greek government, mm-hmm. Times gone by, Greek government's got into trouble many times. They would devalue their currency, which is like paying back people with funnier money, and that would reduce their debt burden. Now, they can't do that. They're in the euro. It's up to, you know, the collective nations to decide on how many euros are printed.
I don't know how gold or silver became the coin of the realm or why it became seen as the most valuable commodity on the planet. I suppose it could have been uranium. It could have been titanium if they had it around back then. But it was gold and silver. And at one point in time, China decided that they would use paper to exchange for goods and services. What convinced them and then the other nations that followed suit that paper could be something that we could exchange with the promise of value?
I think, well, it's you start off in two ways. A, it's the government imposing itself. So if you go back to the 10th century when the Chinese were doing it, and the 11th century when, the 12th century when Marco Polo noticed it, then you had the Khans, that they were very fierce people. You had to accept this paper money with their face of the ruler on it, or as a trader you'd be executed. So, you know, when the government has absolutely authority, it can make money what it will, it likes to. And that's why we use money today. It's legal tender.
And why did they do that? Simply because it was more convenient to carry it around?
It is, exactly. That's the second reason. If you had to lug gold around every time you wanted to buy something, then you'd be at risk of robbery. It would be extremely inconvenient. So then what we used to, how money, paper money developed in the West, was we put money in the safe of the goldsmith. Uh-huh. The goldsmith would give us a receipt to say you have so-and-so amount of gold, and then you'd hand that receipt over and you would never take the gold out again.
Hence Fort Knox on the government level.
Right.
Where there's allegedly a gazillion dollars in gold in the vault. I'm not sure there is now because you don't back the paper with gold.
No, well, there is. The U.S. is the biggest single gold holder still, but it's not. You know, if you try to use it to back the currency, the gold price would have to be very high indeed. But you know, the trouble was in the interwar period between the First and Second World Wars, when they tried to go back to the gold standard, the U.S. and France had nearly all the gold, so other countries didn't have enough gold to trade with. And somebody said about the Great Depression, you know, again, it stayed in the Bank of England vault. So all you would do is you'd move a little label saying Germany, gold, and move it over to the US pile of gold when they did a transfer. So somebody once said that the Great Depression only occurred because the gold was in the wrong side of the room. And if they just moved the gold, some of the gold to the other side of the room, all our problems would have been solved.
Great Britain controlled the world economy in the 19th century, and for much of the 20th century, we have controlled the world economy, I guess. When that shift occurred across the pond, why did it occur? Did it occur because of debt run up by Great Britain, or were there other forces at work?
No, it was the First World War, and which really destroyed Britain's capacity to stand at the center of the system. So Britain had maintained the gold standard for almost 200 years. It was first the result of Sir Isaac Newton's actions, funnily enough, in the early 18th century. It had a very sound currency, the most advanced economy, and it was already losing its relative economic position to the US and Germany before the First World War, but still people trusted it because it had been the centerpiece of the system. Mm-hmm. Then in the course of the First World War, it had to sell much of its overseas assets to pay its bills. And when it emerged from the First World War, it just wasn't strong enough to play that role of centerpiece of the system. The US emerged as a centerpiece of the system. Benjamin Strong was the head of the Federal Reserve, and it was the first time it had a central bank and the Federal Reserve and managed the system. And then when the whole system was remade again after the Second World War, what was called the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. was the centerpiece of that.
So when the standard currency of the world shifted from the pound to the dollar, what was the impact on Great Britain and the people living there?
Well, the pound fell very, very steadily from just before the First World War. I think it was around $5 to the pound just before the First World War, and now it's, what, $1.50. To the pound. So that over 100 years, the pound has lost a lot of its value, which means effectively a cut in the standard of living because, you know, in all commodities are priced in dollars. So we as Britons have to buy our oil in dollars and our wheat and so on in dollars. And so it's harder for us to buy it because our pounds go less far. So it is a devaluation over time is a cut in your standard of living.
So who is likely to control the 21st century economy?
Well, if you look at, as I say, this is one of these great crises. And when the crisis is over, the creditor who is usually lost out. So if you think of China, who's likely to be who's the biggest creditor at the moment, they own all these treasury bonds which pay less than 2% in a currency they don't control. So they are at terrible risk that the US will devalue the dollar or even, you know, inflate away the debt. So then they will insist on some new system. So it'll be eventually probably a Chinese devised system. What does China like? China doesn't like free-floating currencies. China doesn't like free capital markets. So we'll have a more managed international system, some deal with the US. Not next year, you know, not 2014. It takes many years for these systems to unfold.
You say by 2020?
2020 is just a rough guess. And the reason I say that is because it took about 10 years or so for after the collapse of the gold standard for the new system to
emerge. This is the new world order you're talking about.
It is the new world order.
Is this inevitable? Is it deigned? Is it for, you know, there was no way to stop this?
No, it's not inevitable. There are many ways it could play out. So China could become the replacement currency, reserve currency of the world. The renminbi could replace the dollar. And, you know, if you wanted a bet on which currency will go up over the next 10 years, you're an international investor, you'd pick the Chinese currency, not the dollar.
Because they hold all the debt? Because they're a growing
because
economy?
Because the economy is growing stronger, because they have a trade surplus, not a trade deficit. So it's, you know, they are likely to see their currency appreciate over the long run. But, of course, the big difference is if you wanted to invest in China, they don't let you invest easily. It's not easy. It's not a liquid market. It's not easy to buy and sell. And you wouldn't trust the Chinese authorities always to look after your interests in a crisis. Whereas the U.S., you know, still the world's largest economy, has a trusted legal system and so on.
Will that change? If they assume control of the world's currency or they become the dominant economic power, will they have to become what Britain was and what the United States is? More trusted? Will they have to be more open to trade? And will they have to favor open markets?
I think they're edging that way. So you're allowing renminbi offshore accounts to be open. London, we are angling to be the center for where it all gets traded, try and nick the market off you guys in New York. And so they are moving slowly that way. The question is whether they'll move quickly enough. So even in the 1950s, Britain's pound was still used as a reserve currency 40 years after we were no longer.
Because I've done important. A number of shows with people who deal with China as business people, and to a person, they cast aspersions on China and the honesty of people that they do business with there. And the fact that there is, and I'm not going to put it, whether it's wrong or right, there's simply a different moral code. There's simply a different way of looking at things in that culture as opposed to Western culture. If that doesn't change, what happens to the whole world? How do we deal with each other? Because if we're going, you know, decided last night in the presidential debate that China allegedly steals product ideas and produces counterfeit products and then sells them all over the world, including in the United States. If they don't hold intellectual property at any value, how can we trust them about anything?
Well, I you're right, it's a problem, but it was a problem that dogged the European nations and the American nations, American nation before. I mean, many American states defaulted in the 19th century, never paid back their European creditors, for example. Britain's industrial development was stolen, you know, the ideas were stolen by manufacturers in Germany and France. Britain itself stole some of the ideas for its original textile industry from France and from India. So this kind of thing happens in developing nations all the time. It's in the last 40 or 50 years that in the West we've developed systems and we've become very proper about it. But when we were trying to become rich, we weren't quite so scrupulous. So yes, the Chinese do break lots of rules, but maybe in 20, 30 years' time, and we're talking about the long sweep of history, they'll be worried about Vietnam stealing their ideas and Russia, and so they will be more inclined to go with our system.
Is most of our debt in this country held by China and the Middle East, or is it held by individual Americans who have bought bonds, etc.?
Most of American debt is held by Americans. But
so why is the power then shifting to China?
Well, it's most of the government debt, or the biggest single holders of the government debt, let's put it that way, rather than the majority, is held by foreign investors. So the big holders, the Chinese, the Japanese, those are held by China. Of course, China would like to own more of America's businesses, but Congress is not very keen to let that happen.
If you are a creditor and you can't pay back a loan, who really loses? Is it you or is it the lender?
It depends on what sort of loan it is. So if it's a house and you lose your house and the lender loses the security on the house as well, then both of you are losing, aren't you?
But if you're
If it's a government, it depends how badly the creditors penalize you afterwards. So Argentina, for example, defaulted in the early 2000s, has not yet come to a deal with its creditors, and the Argentine economy has been growing fairly rapidly since. So Argentina probably hasn't suffered as much as you might expect.
Because I was going to ask you, if we face this, the prospect of China becoming the world economic power and the Chinese currency eclipsing the dollar and the pound and the euro, etc., and we're afraid of this, why not just default? Let them hold the paper. Who cares?
Well, you'd be defaulting to everybody, of course. It's very hard to default just to one of your creditors. And you'd be defaulting to the banks that own treasury bonds. You'd be defaulting to your allies that own treasury bonds.
So it's not an option.
I don't think it's an option. And it doesn't need to be an option yet. The U.S. is some years away from that sort of crisis.
Now, you point out that something similar to this happened in the 1930s when the gold standard was abandoned. And I think there was something else went on in the 1930s as well. But in the 70s, when fixed exchange rates were dropped by the Nixon administration, it happened again. Most people don't remember the first thing happening because most people were not around. But I was around in the 70s, and I don't remember that either. So how bad was it then, and what was the outcome of the 1970s, fixed exchange rate situation going away?
Well, it was the first time in history that you'd have paper money with no metallic backing whatsoever. So from 1971, the link between the dollar and gold was gone, and it's not come back. People worried that that would lead to very high inflation if you ever let governments, you know, have control of paper money like that. And what did we have in the 1970s? Very high inflation. You had it round the world. Mm-hmm. Exchange rates moved very rapidly, much more rapidly than the sort of free market economists who wanted floating exchange rates suggested would happen. And you had regular crises in Europe over the level of exchange rates. You had the stagflation problem, the Carter malaise that often crops up in presidential debates. And it was only really when we learned how to stabilize the system, which Paul Volcker did when he was head of the Federal Reserve. He raised interest rates so far that it eventually kicked inflation out of the system, that you really got something stable. So you can view that as the last breakdown of the system in the early 1970s. And again, it took about 9 or 10 years for it to be sold.
That's when CDs were paying 18%.
Absolutely.
And when mortgages cost you 18 or 19 or 20%. Yeah. Not a good time. I remember that distinctly. And you date what has happened recently to that?
Yes.
So all an outgrowth of that?
Up until then, you couldn't run, you know, huge trade deficits year after year after year. Your exchange rate would come into trouble. Mm-hmm. You'd get into trouble. The amount of credit the banks could create was tightly controlled. But after about 1980, the banks were liberalized, and suddenly it became a lot easier to do. Up until 1980, it wasn't, you know, bankers didn't earn an awful lot more than the normal people in the population. It was a dull sort of job. Fund management, they weren't, you know, it's a dull sort of job. Suddenly, when you have debt, and the debt's used to buy assets, and when the central bank always intervenes when the market wobbles, you kind of have a one-way bet. What we really did is think of it as a casino. We created lots of chips, and we handed them out to people and said, go and have a gamble in the casino, yeah. See how you get on. Some of them did extremely well. And then what happens when those people lost? We give them some more chips.
But you end up with banks that are too big to fail.
Yeah.
Had we not abandoned the gold standard, could we have had the advancement of standards of living that we have experienced in the last 100 or so years? Because gold is a finite object.
Yes.
Could we have had this kind of advancement?
Well, clearly, gold is a very inflexible object. The having the economic health of mankind depend on whether you happen to dig some metal up in Alaska or South Africa or something is very strange. Having some kind of limit on the amount of credit that's created, that's a different matter. And I think the gold standard was kind of rough proxy for that. What we failed to do when we got rid of gold was control it some other way.
Philip Coggan is our guest. His book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. And we will continue our conversation about all of this in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members, and Blumenthal Performing Arts presents Sister Act, a divine musical comedy. A wannabe diva hides out in a convent, rediscovering her voice. January 8th through 13th, Ovens Auditorium. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Coming up in about 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show, Congress passed new tax and spending legislation late last night to avert the fiscal cliff. Analysis of the new law and prospects for compromise on other key issues, including gun control, immigration, and U.S. energy policy, are all on the table for discussion in the first hour of The Diane Rehm Show. A reminder, this is a holiday rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks, so we won't be able to take your phone calls this morning, but we'll get back to this conversation about paper promises in just a moment.
Before you even walk out the door, let NPR's Daily News Magazine Morning Edition take you on a trip around the world. Meet the people and visit the places in the headlines. Discover others you didn't know existed. You can get the culturally rich experiences that come with a stamp in your passport without the jet lag. So go places with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen for Morning Edition starting at 5, weekdays on 90.7 WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Philip Coggin is our guest, the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist and author of Paper Promises, Money, Debt, and the New World Order, a book that has been described as a remarkable one from one of the most respected economics journalists on the planet.
Didn't say which planet.
The planet indicates us, I would say. He's in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. He speaks today at 11:30 at Bentley's on 27th. Information on that on our website at WFAE.org. You talk in this book about the cyclical nature of these crises and how they come back to haunt us time and time and time again, and how they do when we get out of them. The order of the world, economically speaking, does shift. So how did we get ourselves out of some of these previous crises, and is there anything we can take from how we got out of those and apply it to what we're facing today around the world?
Well, let's go for the 1970s. So we just mentioned. So eventually we figured out how to control inflation, which was the big problem. So that was Paul Volcker. So that was central bank action. The 1930s, the war really was the biggest single factor, unfortunately, to get us out of the depression, because suddenly expenditure shot up and people were in employment. And if we go back to the 1890s, we had, while William Jennings Bryan was campaigning saying gold was too limiting, they were discovering lots of gold, which actually was helping to solve the problem.
Explain, because people have said before that we got out of the Great Depression because of World War II, the need to build tanks and machine guns and things like that. But if there was no money, because there was no money, people were on the street selling apples, how did we pay the manufacturers of these tanks and guns and airplanes? On credit?
Yes, we paid. Yes,
so definitely. War is not a growth activity. It is a destructive activity.
You're right.
So how do you then not fall back into the Great Depression with a massive amount of debt at the end of a war?
Well, how we got out of the debt we had at the end of the war is very interesting. Actually, maybe explain how we're going to get out of this debt. So after the Second World War, interest rates were held very low for a very long time, and inflation wasn't, you know, huge, but it was significant enough that the debt was slowly eroded. The second thing is that the U.S. had basically was the dominant economic power of the world and helped fund the reconstruction of Europe, so that Europe, which was in ruins after the Second World War, obviously was a huge customer base for the U.S., and so it helped revive Europe as well.
So when we talk about, sometimes, certain people talk about American exceptionalism, are we also the beneficiary of great luck?
America has been this fantastic beneficiary because it's had everything going for it. So it has not been invaded in wars like many European countries have. It has, for the much of the 19th century, was expanding its territory. So it had new frontiers to conquer. For much of the 20th century, it was expanding its population. So it had these underlying growth factors, which you look at China now and see that happening. So what's the biggest thing that's happening in China? That people who were peasant farmers, who were very unproductive, are working in factories, and the economy is growing very fast.
Did Britain look at America with the same trepidation that we regard China with today?
I think in commercial terms it did, but luckily the two by that stage were friends and allies, so it wasn't a military problem.
Now, at the end of World War II, Germany was decimated physically and morally and spiritually in every way. And as you say, we did help to build it, but at the same time we were helping to the Allies were trying to rebuild Germany. Germany split into East and West. And so several years ago, they reunited, and West Germany took on incredible problems they inherited from East Germany, which had been under communist control and was well behind the West economically and in every other way. And yet today, Germany is the most economically healthy state in the Eurozone. How did they do that?
Well, Germany has been fantastic at keeping its productivity up, at having a strong manufacturing sector that exports stuff to Asia. And that, I think, is the key factor that most countries need to think about. If you want to import stuff, and we all do, whether it's energy or raw materials or electronic goods, we have to have things that we make that other countries want to buy. And that's the real problem when you go into Europe and Greece and Spain and things. People don't really realize and think about that the world doesn't owe them a living, that they need to have industries that produce things. And profit is still, a dirty word in some parts of Southern Europe. So, and that's what America... why it's easiest to be most optimistic of all the developed nations about America, because America still has globally leading industries in things like technology, in pharmaceuticals, in the media. And it is still the most inventive place on the planet when you look at things like patents.
So is it possible then to do what we did at the end of World War II and grow ourselves, economically speaking, out of this morass?
I think it's possible for America to do it. I don't think it's possible for Europe to do it. And the reason is that, as I mentioned before, Europe's population and parts of Europe is likely to fall. If your population falls, it's hard for your economy to grow. And in America, you don't have that.
And how will that impact America's ability to grow itself out or reverse course on this economic crisis?
Well, that's why it's so difficult for the next few years ahead, because you've got Europe, which is as big in population terms and economic terms as America when you aggregate the whole thing together, is going to be struggling. You've got Japan, which is 20 years down this line of having a slow economy and an aging population and having too much debt. That's going to be struggling. So what's going to happen in America? America's orienting its foreign policy, it's orienting its commercial policy towards Asia. And America can benefit as Asia becomes like Europe now, Asia, or Europe of 30, 40 years ago, as it develops a prosperous middle class, a middle class who is still hungry for American brands and American goods. Coca-Cola, jeans, all those sorts of things are still popular in the rest of the world.
Given that, why are you relatively certain that the economic balance of power will shift to China?
The financial power has shifted to China already. So the problem is, if you run up debts to another country, debts that you're unlikely to be able to repay in real terms, then eventually there'll be a crisis. China has 3.2 trillion of foreign exchange reserves at the moment. Will it really want 5 trillion, 7 trillion? Will the Americans want to keep running a deficit to China? That's where I think the crisis will come.
In the European Union, some of the stronger nations are demanding austerity of the nations that are being helped out of this economic crisis. And some economists assert that that approach will slow recovery there. And in this country, Republicans have criticized the Bush and Obama stimulus packages, while some say there wasn't enough stimulus money to make a real difference, that if more money had gone into this, we would be further ahead today than we are. What is the right approach?
Well, of course, if I could solve all the world's problems, I should be president of the planet. But the key, I think, is to have a medium-term plan for bringing down the deficit whilst not being too austere in the short term while the economy is weak. So if you look at America's position relative to other countries' financial crisis, America's doing quite well. There's two great economists, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, who've done studied this and produced a very good book 2 or 3 years ago about debt crisis. And they say America's doing as well as could be expected given the level of the crisis. In Europe, we're not doing as well, and we haven't handled it as well. America still needs a plan for, fixing the deficits in Social Security and Medicare, but those are things that can be done over 10, 20 years. Doesn't have to be done tomorrow.
I don't want to put you on the spot politically here, but I would like to get a European perspective on this. You're not an American citizen, correct?
No. And
you do...
I'm married to one.
Yes, but home base is where?
It's
London. And you write for The Economist,
yes,
which is a London-based economics publication. I'd just like to get your take on where we are, how we got here in America, and what the right approach to get out is, because we are having this election in 2 weeks or so, and we have two different views of how this ought to be. And one side is being very critical of how it's been handled in the last 4 years, while the other side is saying, we're doing the best we can, which I think is what you just said, and give us four more years and we'll be better off than we were in 2008. We inherited a mess. I'd just like to get your perspective on it.
Well, I think you can criticize both sides on this, in the problem that they don't have very specific plans for getting out of the mess. You know, that although the Republicans talk a good game about how it's immoral to run up these deficits, when you actually try and pin down their program and say, what is it that you're going to cut that is actually going to save all this money? Because, of course, they don't believe in tax increases. And on the Democrat side, you can say that, you know, they have argued for greater taxes on the well-off, and you know, given the rising inequality in America, that's not too surprising. But greater taxes on the well-off on their own will not solve the deficit crisis. So it may well be that the way that democracy works is that it makes it very difficult to solve a financial crisis because voters don't want to hear that they're going to suffer. And this is a sort of central argument in my book, that somebody has to lose out from this excess debt. And it's either going to be creditors, it's going to be taxpayers paying more tax, or it's going to be people who get benefits from the government who won't get the benefits they think they're entitled to. And in different countries, that's going to work out in different ways.
What would your approach be? You're the president.
In America, okay. So you're going to have to retire later in America. You are going to have to
later being what?
Later
67,
being
70?
70, heading for 70 by 2050, yeah, and moving steadily towards that level. So you give people plenty of time.
By 2050?
By 2050, yes.
Okay.
Because we've essentially had five more years added to our longevity over the last 40, and we've taken it all as leisure. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can do that. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to limit the spending on healthcare. Now, I'm from Britain. I have part of the National Health Service, which I'm used to. It's free care, but we spend, I think, 6 or 7% of GDP on health, and our longevity is longer than that of the average American.
And what do we spend on health?
11, 12, I think the figures are. So if you can draw all the lines of the Western world on a graph, and you can compare the spending on health and the length of life. And America's way off the charts. They spend the most on health, but they don't have the longest life expectancy. They don't.
Why don't we believe that? We do not believe that. We will not believe it. We think you're lying to us.
I know. Well, I think that there are three things. There are three things that you've got. You've got cost, you've got choice, and you've got coverage. Okay. So in Britain, we have universal coverage. We keep the cost down, but you don't have a choice. You can't choose your doctor. If you go to the ER department, you might wait 3 or 4 hours.
And who makes that decision? If you can't make the decision about which doctor you see, who makes that decision? A bureaucrat?
It's the first it's the first doctor who's available. So you can't choose old Dr. Smith, who's been with us.
Well, how does that work if you have to go back repeatedly? If you have a chronic condition, do you see a different doctor every time?
No, you wouldn't. But if you'd go to the hospital that is in your area, and you wouldn't be able to just go anywhere. You have to limit it somewhere. So if you don't limit the cost and you give people if you give people choice, you can't limit the cost, or you can't treat everybody. And in America, of course, you've got this very high cost, and many people aren't treated.
So let's get off healthcare and move back to how do you fix America.
Before everybody phones in to complain.
That's right.
Well, I think the other thing is the education system that, my wife is American. She's very keen for our kids to be educated in Britain. There's a feeling that America is not producing enough high school kids with the requisite education to do the kind of jobs that are needed. Universities of America, of course, are world class and they're brilliant, but they're very expensive and it's hard for the average person to go there.
Is that because our public school system has to deal with a non-homogenous population? They must take everybody who wants to walk through the door, and some of them don't speak English. Some of them come from different cultures and backgrounds. Some of them are poverty-stricken. Some of them have other challenges, whereas in other countries, it's pretty much a similar experience.
Well, you should come to London, and, yeah, exactly. We have refugees. We have schools where there are 16 different languages spoken. So
why are you better off?
Well, we're not perfect by any means, but we are now experimenting, reforming, letting headmasters set up their own schools, giving more control to the schools, and focusing not so much on top-down, rewarding teachers for good performance. That's also important.
Will taxes here have to rise? Will military spending here have to be reduced? can we maintain our position as the world's policeman under this economic crisis? Or can we safely reduce our military budget and still maintain hegemony?
I think it was on the debate last night, wasn't it, that America spends as much as the next 10 nations
yes,
in the world.
Yes, I thought it was more than that.
It certainly, I think, accounts for about half all military spending in the world. So you would think there might be some money to be lost out of that budget. And, of course, the way that wars, military actions are going is that you depend more on those kind of teams of SEALs to attack Osama bin Laden
but
and less
on... But if you're trying to come out of a crisis, an economic crisis, and you cut the military budget, you're cutting jobs.
Yes.
And you're cutting pieces of equipment that are made around the country. How can you do that and come out of the crisis? If you're saying we're canceling that airplane that's $2 million an airplane, and we ordered 90 of them.
Well, what about other infrastructure though within the states? I mean, I drive a reasonable amount when I'm on vacation here, and mm-hmm. there are plenty of roads that could be improved.
Yes.
You don't have a particularly strong national railway system.
We don't have any national railways.
Well, my in-laws came back from San Francisco to New York, and I think they had to go by coach, you know, by bus half the time. So, there are plenty of things in America which could be improved that the public service could be spent.
I'm 30 seconds left. Yeah. Ordinary people, as we face this crisis, trying to come out of it, face uncertainty about the tax structure, face the fact that the dollar may be eclipsed by the renminbi. What should we do, ordinary citizens, do to protect their assets, their investments, their futures?
They should save more. If you've got a choice, it may not work at the national level, but individual people, interest rates are extremely low. If you want a good retirement income, you should be piling up your savings, and you should have you should have some of that savings in assets that are protected against inflation. The American government issues these TIPS, which are inflation-linked government bonds. I'm not here to give investment advice, but those are assets which are safe and protect you against inflation. So you wouldn't want to be looking out 10 or 20 years and feel that if inflation suddenly emerged, my savings could go to pot.
And, of course, medical costs are predicted Absolutely. To rise exponentially, yeah. Yeah, so you should be saving extra for that too,
yes,
right?
That's true.
Philip Coggin is the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist. His book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. That's a scary title. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.